Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, James Dunbar discusses his archaeological work at Wakulla Springs.
There are artifacts we probably will also be able to find botanical remains, maybe even some genetic, those kind of things that you don't usually get on land.
We'll discuss Florida women in the martial arts from the mid-1970s to the mid-80s.
The quest for equality in the dojo played out against the backdrop of the second wave of feminism in Florida and the nation.
And we'll hear about the death of a child at Mission San Luis. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Wash all the artifacts according to, you know, if it's pottery, you want to wash it in water. If it's bone, you just want to leave it alone. You just want to get it cleaned out so that I can do the analysis of the artifacts.
Bridget Borders is the on-site lab manager at the Wakulla Springs Archaeological Dig.
Yeah, so they'll get stored in the racks overnight so they can dry out so we don't get any mold. Mm-hmm. And then I will identify what the object is, the material. If it's pottery, I'll identify what kind of pottery it is. And then I'll give it a number so it can be found later on. I put all the information into a spreadsheet. And then little bags get all their little information on it, you know, everything that we know about it on each little bag. And then it gets sent to the archives at the end of the season once we've done all of our analysis.
Some exciting discoveries are being made by archaeologists working at Wakulla Springs in northwest Florida, where James Dunbar is the principal investigator. In the 1980s, working at the Page Ladson site just 25 miles from Wakulla Springs, Dunbar helped to prove that people and mastodon coexisted in Florida nearly 15,000 years ago, much earlier than previously believed.
Dave Webb, who is now professor emeritus at the University of Florida, he was a vertebrate paleontologist, and he and I got together in 1983, seems like the other day, and started the Acilla Research Project and found a site that was named Page Ladson. And after several years of work and carbon dates and all kinds of different samples, we determined that we had a component that was, well, actually 14,500 years old. And that's a battery of very, very many radiocarbon dates. And the beauty of that site is that it's about 30 feet below sea level in the middle of the river. But because it's that far down and water sort of pooled in that depression through time, fragile organic things like gourd seeds were preserved, and mastodon digesta, which is the gut tract of a mastodon, and we had a mastodon down there that had died, and we have evidence that it was, if not killed, butchered. And I think they hunted it and they butchered it, but the hunting part you can't quite prove. But that turned out to be very controversial because for 75 years, there had been this paradigm called Clovis First, and everybody knew there wasn't anything in the Americas older than Clovis. So when we came out with the book, it caused a lot of controversy, and we had a second opinion done later on by Texas A&M University and their underwater archaeologist, and they found the same identical thing we did. So it is a bona fide pre-Clovis site that's one of the oldest well-documented in North America right now.
Dunbar and his team are continuing a history of archaeology at Wakulla Springs that goes back to the mid-19th century.
The history of Wakulla Springs and its underwater resources goes back to 1850. George King was a prominent sort of adventurer that came down to Wakulla and recovered almost an intact mastodon. And somehow he transferred that mastodon to P.T. Barnum, who put it in his museum. And it appears we're still doing the historic research on it. Andy Hemmings, who works with us, is doing this. But it appears that maybe the mastodon was pulled out of there before that museum burned down in 1865. And so there's sort of a pedigree there. Later in 1930, Herman Gunter came in with the Florida Geological Survey, recovered an intact mastodon, and it is now on display at the Florida Museum of History here in Tallahassee. But what nobody knew at the time is that they also found artifacts that would be old enough to be associated with that mastodon. But there was such a controversy at that time about were people even here in the country during the time the big animals were around. By about 1935, that had been demonstrated. And by 1941, one of the Geological Survey employees wrote a letter to an archaeologist saying, well, we found two of these projectile points with that mastodon.
Dunbar heads the Osceola Research Institute, and the excavation in and around Wakulla Springs continues today under his direction.
In 2018, we went back and we were looking at yet a different mastodon, and we just barely got a peek at it. Did a little bit of testing, know that it's laying on its side with the head and the backbone sort of facing to the north and the legs facing to the south. It's in sediment that would suggest that river was flowing at the time. It has something in the sediment that's called the banded mystery snail. And it's a species that's no longer extant in Wakulla Springs, probably too much saltwater intrusion when hurricanes happen. We don't know why they became extinct, but the mastodon is clearly in sediment that's Pleistocene age. And we're just now getting a little bits and pieces back. Apparently it's rich in pollen, it's rich in botanical, and so we'll find some other things out.
Edward Ball bought what is now the Wakulla Springs State Park in 1931, where he built a hotel called Wakulla Lodge. In 1955, archaeologist Calvin Jones found some interesting artifacts on the site, some of which have gone missing. Today, some of the oldest artifacts created by human beings in Florida are found only in photographs.
The lodge has a mastodon upper max. It's sort of the roof of the mouth with the tooth rows, and it's on display. It was on display in the 1970s when the late Dan Morris, who was a physical anthropologist at FSU, took photographs of the mastodon palate, and inside the palate was a Simpson point. And when the state went to buy the property, that point disappeared, which is very unfortunate. So it always occurred to us that maybe the preform, we say it's a Simpson, but how do we really know it's a Simpson? Well, we solved that this year and found a Simpson point in place, which is always good to have that verification. But we went to the site to begin with because of what happened at Page Latson and some of the tool types that we didn't find in place there. They were from displaced context, were being found by Calvin in an in place in situ situation. So we went back to try to define this, what looks like a fledgling new culture, if you want to call it that. Some of the very earliest Americans and as of 2018, we have an idea of what their toolkit looks like a little bit more. We have some dates that are coming in that I would say, roughly speaking, it's going to be about 13,600 to 14,300 years old. And that older date really is very close to Page Latson's site age. And the questions we now have are, do we have one cultural expression or two that are pre-Clovis? Is Simpson one thing and Page Latson another? And if that's the case, Page Latson may be a little bit older and Simpson somewhere a little bit younger. But what's interesting about the Simpson manufacture technique, it looks like it's the ancestor of Clovis to me. The way they're flaking it is really interesting.
So at the Page-Ladson site, Dunbar and his team proved that human beings and megafauna like mastodon occupied what would become Florida at the same time almost 15,000 years ago. It appears that his current excavations at Wakulla Springs will support that finding.
And that was one of our main missions, to come to Wakulla. At the Page-Ladson site, there was no land-based stratigraphy that was worth it. It was only very thin sediments. At Wakulla, we knew we had 1, 2, 3 meters of sediment column, which would give you the stratigraphic separation, sort of the layer cake of time, if you want to call it that, to be able to find different components in their proper stratigraphic position. And we've pretty much done that. But the other part of our mission is to try to see if we can correlate whatever is on land with what is being found out underwater. And like I say, we just barely scratch the surface on the underwater part of it, but it's there.
James Dunbar is amazed by the technological advancements that have been made in the tools that archaeologists use, such as blood residue analysis, radiocarbon dating, and 3D imaging.
I had a professor way back in the 70s, Charles Fairbanks, and he knocked into our heads that you don't try to go into an archaeological site and dig the whole thing, because 20 years from now, there are going to be new techniques and new testing methods you can't even dream of. And I'm living proof that that's true, because OSL dating, for example, didn't exist until the geologists started perfecting that in 2000. It became mainline and was starting to be used on archaeological sites. And by 2008, we used it at Wakulla Springs, and now we're using it again. And what optically stimulated luminescence dating is, it will date the last time a grain of sand saw sunlight. So you gotta starve it, keep it starved to sunlight. The person that did the OSL dating for us, a fellow named Jim Feathers, I think he separates out about 250 single grains of very, very fine grained sand and dates each individual sand grain. That's really beneficial in Florida. It gives you an age, but it also gives you an idea of the stratigraphic integrity of a site, which is important.
Now that we know that people and megafauna coexisted at Wakulla Springs between 14 and 15,000 years ago, Dunbar says there is much more to discover about Florida's indigenous people.
I think the most important thing to be thinking about is that we have a culture or cultures that were here prior to the time of Clovis. So it's older than we thought, let me put it that way. And because that now has been shown at Page-Ladson, and I think we can show it now at Wakulla, now we have to fall back and say, okay, what's this culture about, and try to find to the best of our ability its, you know, cultural toolkit that they use to make everyday living and that kind of thing. And if we're so fortunate to find an underwater site that has their artifacts, we probably will also be able to find botanical remains, maybe even some genetic, those kind of things that you don't usually get on land. But the site combination of, there's something right on land that's pre-Clovis, and there's something out there underwater that I think is going to be Clovis or pre-Clovis, is exciting, say the least.
Archaeologist Jim Dunbar will discuss his work further as a featured speaker at the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Tallahassee Historical Society Bicentennial Conference, May 16th through 18th. More information is at myfloridahistory.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where you can now register for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Tallahassee Historical Society Bicentennial Conference, being held May 16th through 18th. Each morning at the Four Points Hotel, you can attend fascinating presentations and panel discussions, including a talk from Jim Dunbar, who you just heard discussing his work at Wakulla Springs. Each afternoon, we'll tour historic sites, museums, and archives, including the Historic State Capitol Museum, Goodwood Museum and Gardens, Mission San Luis, the John G. Riley House Museum, and more. You can enjoy a performance by Theater with a Mission, our annual Florida Historical Society Awards Luncheon, and our banquet dinner with keynote speaker Mary Adkins discussing Florida constitutional law. Find out more at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, we've had several segments dealing with sports history, but I don't believe we discussed women's sports. The 1970s brought a new emphasis on existing women's athletics, including track, volleyball, tennis, softball, and basketball. Several sports that had been traditionally male also expanded to include women, including martial arts.
In the fall 2014 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly, Christopher David Thrasher published an article titled "A Few Crazy Ladies" that focused on female martial arts in Florida in the period 1974 to 1983. He got his title from a letter by Karen Swanson from North Florida that was published in the 1974 issue of Black Belt magazine. Swanson congratulated the magazine's editors on their decision to launch a column by historian and martial artist Valerie Eads with the provocative title Fighting Women. Swanson indicated her desire to learn self-defense, but lamented the lack of female instructors in North Florida. Male instructors were uniformly unwilling to take on female students. Facing seemingly insurmountable barriers, she claimed most women gave up on the idea of learning self-defense, except for a few crazy ladies. Thrasher uses his article to explore the way determined women broke down the barriers to female participation in martial arts in Florida. The quest for equality in the dojo played out against the backdrop of the second wave of feminism in Florida and the nation. Thrasher's article is grounded in feminist historiography of empowerment and the role of sports in pushing feminism into the heartland, most notably in the 1972 Battle of the Sexes tennis matches between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. Thrasher notes that several historians, including Carol A. Wiley, Patricia Searless, and Ronald Berger, have published monographs and articles on women as martial artists, but did not address women in the South. His work fills that gap in the historiography by examining the struggle for acceptance in martial arts schools in Florida. Southern women, he claims, particularly in Florida, faced extraordinary challenges as they battled conservative attitudes common among both men and women in the area. As a thriving women's rights movement gained traction in Gainesville, these women promoted martial arts in an effort to increase women's physical fitness, psychological health, and their ability to defend themselves against violent attacks.
The mid-20th century was the moment when American men embraced Asian martial arts. Was there a history of women as martial artists?
Americans became aware of martial arts in the 19th century, but general interest in becoming martial artists emerged after World War II with veterans who fought in Asia. The Korean and Vietnam Wars increased that interest. In 1961, a Los Angeles group of martial artists launched a new magazine, Black Belt, to serve that interest. As the number of martial artists schools expanded, NBC Sports began televising martial arts tournaments in 1965. The popularity increased with the advent of Bruce Lee as a crime-fighting martial artist in the TV series The Green Hornet, 1966 and 67. Women in martial arts were not unknown even in the 19th century. In 1884, Yoshiaki Yamashita toured the United States with his wife Fude, who was also a martial artist. As one historian suggested, Fude's position in the martial arts demonstrations was, quote, a performative act in itself, a conscious cultivation and self-expressive display of the body in which women disputed the notion that fighting arts was an exclusively male domain, and presents compelling visual evidence that women were capable of demonstrating proficiency in the martial arts, end quote. In 1913, English suffragette Sylvia Pankhurst encouraged her followers to learn jiu-jitsu in order to defend themselves against the police who disrupted their marches and public protest actions. In 1959, female judo expert Rena Kanakogi, alias Rusty Glickman, disguised herself as a man and won the YMCA New York State Championship against male opponents. In 1961, openly fighting as a woman, she defeated a male opponent in a bout sponsored by the Amateur Athletic Union of New York. The AAU banned females from participation in all future events.
Connie, the 1970s brought a number of women's issues to the forefront. The implementation of Title IX and consideration of the Equal Rights Amendment by the Florida legislature, to name two. In addition, the state experienced a rise in sexual assaults and rapes, as well as the assaults, rapes, and murders committed by Ted Bundy.
That's correct. Thrasher provides a timeline of events for understanding the progress made by female martial artists. Florida women, especially at the colleges and universities, became more aware of their own potential and demanded changes. In 1971, women at New College in Sarasota demanded self-defense classes. Susan Murdoch, a New York karate instructor, promoted self-defense in a story run by the Lakeland Ledger. The following year, the Ocala Star-Ledger repeated Murdoch's call for self-defense instruction for women. Florida proponents of martial arts for women were aware that female fighters demanded that judges hold them to the same standards as male fighters. An anonymous male writer to Black Belt argued that, quote, respect stood at the center of everything good about the martial arts and urged male martial artists to show respect for both men and women, end quote. In 1973, the AAU of New York conceded and allowed women to compete under the same rules as men. That year, the ranks of female karate students swelled by a reported 30%. Judo students grew by 15%. In 1975, a group of women in the Northeast, led by Dana Densmore, founded a magazine, Black Belt Women. The same year, Southern California women founded Women in the Martial Arts, WEMA. In Florida, Sylvia Scudder, writing for Woman News, a feminist newspaper published in Gainesville, explained her admiration for the women who organized WEMA. And the Gainesville Women's Health Center sponsored Women's Health Weekend. This health center promoted martial arts as a method for healthy exercise that emphasized balance, flexibility, range of motion, and coordination. It was also viewed as a way of building strong communities of women who rejected traditional gendered boundaries. Scudder acknowledged the exercise and self-defense aspects of martial arts, but she also recognized that greater psychological and spiritual power could be obtained through martial arts. Thrasher claims that the arrival of Beth Mikos, an expert in Korean martial arts of Tang Soo Do, marked an important milestone for Florida female martial artists. Mikos began teaching self-defense courses at Central Florida Community College in 1980. Mikos observed that her students quickly developed a quiet confidence that they absorbed into their daily lives. Also in 1980, Florida women took home more trophies than any other state in the National Taekwondo Championships in Berkeley, California. 2 years later, Thrasher reports, a Florida-based bodyguard company began actively recruiting female martial artists. Thrasher concludes that, quote, Swanson described the anonymous women who fought for equality within Florida's martial arts community as a few crazy ladies. Perhaps crazy ladies is a fitting description for those martial pioneers. They were crazy enough to believe that the martial arts offered benefits that made the struggle worthwhile. They were crazy enough to demand a place at the table. They were even crazy enough to obtain equality, end quote.
Thank you, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Archaeologist Bonnie McEwen studied the area known as Mission San Luis, an Apalachee village and Spanish mission built in 1656 in present-day Tallahassee. She tells us about the death of a child at Mission San Luis.
The history of Spanish Florida is filled with accounts of intrigue and sometimes tragedy. One day at Mission San Luis, near present-day Tallahassee, the wife of the deputy governor told an Apalachee Indian woman to collect chestnuts for her. The woman asked not to go, saying her young daughter had an infirmity and required constant attention. The deputy governor's wife insisted, assuring her that she would watch over the child. When the Apalachee woman returned a few hours later, her daughter was nowhere to be found. Later, the child was discovered drowned in a nearby spring. It is unknown if the little girl wandered off on her own, if she was sent to collect water and had an accident, or if something more sinister took place. Regardless, the death of a child is no less heartbreaking today than it was then, 300 years ago.
Mission San Luis is one of the historic sites that we'll be visiting as part of the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum. This year, the Public History Forum is being held May 16th through 18th in conjunction with the Tallahassee Historical Society Bicentennial Conference. We'll go to the Historic State Capitol Museum, Goodwood Museum and Gardens, the John G. Riley House Museum, and more. Find out more at myfloridahistory.org. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Production assistance comes from Connie Lester. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.